Questions about anything from last time?
Or about anything?
I keep meaning to bring in, there's this famous book by Antoni Zygmunt called Trigonometric Series. It's about that thick. And it just has everything that was known about Fourier series in it at that time. And Stein was a student of Antoni Zygmunt, so that's where I'm sure he got all these this exercises and this fun stuff in his book from. But I actually used a major part of my income as a graduate student to buy that book. It's not the kind of book you can just sit down and read. But Walter Rudin said that he slept with it under his pillow while he was writing his book on, he wrote several books. He wrote one on real and complex analysis, and then he wrote another one on sort of the group theory, because you can look at Fourier analysis as related to what is it called? It blends the analysis with the kind of group theory that comes from the isomorphisms you get from Fourier series. Anyway, it's great stuff. I was looking at writing out solutions to the homework that's due Monday, and once again, Stein's homework problems are fantastic, and I think you get a lot out of them by struggling with them, but I wanted to give you some hints today about them. I meant to bring the book. Does anybody have the book? You have it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Just have a seat.
Let's see. So, if I can remember, the problems work. One of the problems was to mess around with the Poisson kernel. So this was chapter 2, exercise 18. And we had, I guess we wrote out the Poisson kernel in various forms at various times. And the best we ever came up with was when we summed the series that we had, and we came up with 1 minus r squared over 1 minus 2r cosine theta plus r squared. So that's the formula. You should use that formula in this problem to deal with it. And we knew some things about the Poisson kernel. We knew that it's a harmonic function, and it has the various properties of a good kernel. And in this problem, they want you to investigate this function, d by d theta, pr of theta. And so you just calculate the partial derivative of that with respect to theta. And you get a thing that's pretty interesting. That 1 minus r squared is going to come out in front, and so it's going to look like this thing goes to 0 at every boundary point. And so it looks like it's going to be the kind of harmonic function that violates the maximum principle. And I want to explain to you why this thing it doesn't violate the maximum principle. So, but first of all, so you calculate this. You're going to calculate that partial derivative and figure out what that is. By the way, why is this going to be harmonic? This function, after you calculate the this derivative, is going to be harmonic. Why? Your first knee-jerk reaction would be, oh my gosh, now I've got to calculate the Laplacian of this thing. It's a big ugly thing, and I'll have to use the polar version of the Laplacian. You'll succeed if you do that. But I claim there's an easier reason to see that this thing is harmonic. So U Y is U harmonic.
Any sneaky ideas about how you could show that without doing any calculations? I've got to hit it with the Laplacian. So I hit it right here with the Laplacian. I got Laplacian d by d theta of that. Got any ideas yet? So remember, the Laplacian in polar coordinates was d by dr squared plus 1 over r d by dr plus 1 over r squared d2 by d theta squared. Is that what it is? If I was a physics major, I would know that.
I think that's what it is. That's the Laplacian polar coordinate. And it looks like, oh gosh, I've got to calculate this, first calculate it. I'll get something that's not too bad, but then calculating these derivatives are not a whole lot of fun. But it's going to end up to be zero. I'm trying to give you a big hint about why you don't have to go through all that pain. Does anybody see what the trick is? Yeah.
Can't you just write it in the summation form, and then the calculation won't be nearly as bad?
Well, okay, so you want to go back to our formula that we had that was a sum.
Yeah.
And then it'd be just polynomials to deal with.
Right.
You could do that, but we never really knew how well that series converged. Mm-hmm. So when you're going to differentiate a series, you can do that with things like power series, mm-hmm. but to be able to know that the sum of the derivatives goes to the derivative of the sum, you need more conditions to study that. Like, power series would make that work. And in fact, this is a convergent power series in the R variable, and it's very nicely convergent. So all those things can be justified. But I claim that's more work than you need to do, because we know some things about the Poisson kernel. It's kind of like if you take dx by dy, it's the same as taking dy by dx. These things are all infinitely differentiable smooth functions, so it doesn't matter what order you do the derivatives.
And these are linear operators. So what I've been trying to get somebody to think of is, when I hit the Laplacian, so here's the time-saving thing to realize, is that when I hit the Laplacian with d by d theta, it doesn't matter what order I do these linear operators. And
this is zero because we know the Poisson kernel is harmonic.
So we know that this thing is identically zero. And so we get that this is a big fat zero here without doing any calculations. That's what I was trying to save you the pain. Otherwise, you've got to calculate these derivatives
and add them all up. They're going to be zero, but it'll feel like a miracle happens in the end when they all cancel out. But the miracle happens because of this.
Why can you interchange the derivatives?
Because they're linear operators.
Wouldn't you need to... Isn't there some theta at which the bottom of PR of theta...
That's going to be, it will preserve that zero part. On the inside, you're worried, on the boundary, weird things happen. And let's see, you're going to, when you're thinking about what happens at the boundary,
that's when r goes to 1. And so the danger on the is when the bottom thing is going to is tending to zero. And let's see, that would happen. It only happens when cosine is equal to 1. Then that thing on the bottom looks like 1 minus r squared. Otherwise, it doesn't go to go to 0 as r goes to 1. So you're going to have to do cases here. So the next part of the problem is calculating the limit as r goes to 1 of d theta by d theta of pr of theta. The cases where lambda, where theta is not equal to 0 are going to be straightforward. Just do it. The denominator doesn't do anything weird in that case. And you'll see that it goes to 0. So this thing is going to go to 0 if theta is unequal to 0. But if theta is equal to 0, you're going to find that it's identically 0 along that ray. And so the theta equals 0 case is going to be even easier. Because you'll have a sine theta in the top, and that'll be 0.
Professor?
Yeah.
For that case, do you have to be concerned with the fact that the denominator also goes to 0 as r approaches 1?
Right, the denominator does. That's what makes it go to 0. You have a 1 minus r squared. That's going to kill it.
Okay.
You just have to be worried about the denominator going to 0. And the only time that happens, because then you have something going to 0 on top and something going to 0 on the bottom, and you have to worry about maybe something like L'Hopital's rule.
I think that happens in the theta equals 0 case. I think if theta is 0, then if r approaches 1, the denominator and the numerator is 0.
Well, the funny thing about the theta equals 0 case, there's a sine theta in the numerator.
Right.
And that makes it identically 0.
Okay.
Yeah. So, because sine theta equals 0 in the numerator. So this is a really weird looking function. It's harmonic. It's going to be identically 0 along this ray. And if you look at graphs of these things, they get big. Let's see, it's hard to draw graphs. I'm going to try to draw graphs as I go out these various rays. They would look like this. So here's r equals 1. That red one's identically 0, so it's just like this. And then if I did one of these blue lines that's close by, it would start out and be kind of close to 0, but then it would get gigantic and come back down to 0 here. And as I go farther out, that bump would be less, but it would still go to 0. And so let's see, the ones that get really close, they'd be 0 for a long time, and then whammo, they get gigantic, and then they'd come back down to be 0. So this function, the function u, it goes to 0 as you go to in every direction, but it's not bounded. So it's one of those weird functions that it just goes, the nasty spot's right there. It's going to 0 as you go out of each ray, but it shoots up and gets gigantic before it goes to 0. And so this shows you, if you're going to have a maximum principle, this thing looks like, oh, it's 0 on the boundary. The maximum principle should say it's 0. The thing is, it's not continuous up to the boundary everywhere, because this point right here is a really nasty singularity. And so it's not even a bounded function. And so it looks like the maximum principle fails. But it doesn't. Because this function is not bounded. It gets arbitrarily big.
on those little blue lines getting close to the red line. It's not bounded on D1, 0. Even though it goes to 0 along every ray. And it's not, it has a nasty singularity at this spot right here. And a bad singularity at 1. So that's the point of that exercise. And I think once I give you those little hints, it's not going to be too much work to do. Let's see, what was another problem? Oh, number 19 on that one is just to do the usual change. Separation of variables. And it's okay to just do this kind of formally. And any facts you know about boundary value problems in Fourier series? So you'll get a Sturm-Liouville problem. The x problem will be x double prime minus lambda x equals 0. And it'll have boundary conditions x of 0 equals 0 and x of 1 equals 0. We've solved this enough times that you don't have to go through all the work of doing it. You can just write the answer. So we know the lambda. We know the solutions. You don't have to redo it. And we know which lambda give you non-zero, etc. So you don't have to redo that. And so you're going to write out a formal solution. The y problem is going to be y double prime plus lambda y equals 0. And so you're going to get a bunch of solutions, that, and Stein even tells you what they are. You get u of xy equals a sum as n goes from 1 to infinity, a n e to the minus n pi y sine n pi x. And then this is the the heat problem, the steady state heat problem on a semi-infinite strip. As I go from 0 to 1, and the temperature is going to be 0 on these two vertical goalposts, but it's going to be an f of x on the bottom here. And when you try to solve the initial conditions, you realize, aha, I've got a Fourier sine series, and the ans are going to be the coefficients for the Fourier sine series. But the formal part of the problem that you need to do is you need to write out the integrals for the an and pull this apart. So these ans will be given by an integral. And you're going to write out the integral, and then you're going to change the order of summation with the integral. And you're going to get a kernel function. So when you do this, you'll get, let's see, so this is going to be an integral from 0 to 1 of a sum from 1 to infinity. And that sum from 1 to infinity is something you can actually calculate. And you can pull out the f of t dt. And this is the thing that's going to turn out to be the Poisson kernel. So we solved this for the disk and got a Poisson kernel. This is going to be the Poisson kernel for this problem, and it can be summed explicitly. And that's what you're supposed to do in this problem. So this is going to give you a kernel, k, x, y, t.
And so you don't have to prove anything about it. You just have to calculate it and find it.
This is the Poisson kernel for this problem. And guess what? It's just summing a geometric series, basically.
You don't have to clean it up and make it beautiful. You just have to get it in a closed expression. It's not going to be as hard as
maybe I'm implying it would be. Let's see, this an would be an integral. I like to do it in a t variable or something. It's not an xy integral. That's where the f of t comes in. The ans are basically a Fourier sine series. Okay, so I think that's enough hints on those. The best problems are the chapter 3 problems because they have to do with the Gibbs phenomenon. So let's see, this is chapter 3, exercise. What's the one about the Gibbs phenomenon?
It's 20.
20 and 21. The 21 is the one about the Gibbs phenomenon. Let's see, so this problem has to do with Oh, 19 is the one I want to do first. This has to do with the sawtooth function. So let's see, the sawtooth function is f of x equals pi minus x over 2. And let's see, they give it on 0 to 2 pi. So what does that look like? That looks like at 0, it's pi over 2. And 2 pi, it would be minus pi over 2. So it goes like this. It's pi over 2, and it goes to minus pi over 2. And then it repeats. So it's this sawtooth function, like that. And it would be pi over 2 up here, and it would be minus pi over 2 here. And we know that Fourier series would converge to the midpoint of that jump. And the purpose of these two problems is to demonstrate the Gibbs phenomenon, namely that this overshoots that jump by a fixed amount. Let's see, so what's the fixed amount? It's about 9%. So it's going to overshoot the jump by about 9% and then come down and be close. And it's going to overshoot this one by about 9%, then come down and be close. So this is a function you dealt with in previous exercises, and the Fourier series for it. Corresponds to, let's see, what is it? The sum of e to the I n x over n. And everything but n equal to 0. So n not equal to 0. And I guess there's a 1 over 2i in front. Okay, so you've calculated those Fourier coefficients in some previous exercise. And I think you might have also done this trick. When you realize, aha, I've got pluses and minus n's in here, I can write it. Let's take the partial sum, Sn of x. That would be a sum from minus n to n. And n unequal to 0. Let's see, that would give me a sum, as little n goes from 1 to capital N, I'd get some plus n ones. What do I get? I get an e to the I nx over n. That's a plus over n. That's going to be a plus 1. But then the minus 1 would be minus e to the minus I nx, because it would be over minus n. So I'll put the minus up there. And then I had a 1 over 2i in front. If I put this 2i here, then I say, aha, that is the sine function. E to the I nx over minus e to the minus I x over 2i is the sine function. And so this is actually equal to the sum from n equal 1 to capital N of sine nx over n. That's a pretty thing. And you might remember when we cooked up the Dirichlet kernel, the Dirichlet kernel was the sum of those things. What was the Dirichlet kernel? What was the formula for the Dirichlet kernel way back?
Do you want the closed
form? Oh, here it is. Yeah, let's see. I'm going to get the closed form in the end. There's the Thayer kernel. There's the Dirichlet kernel. What is it? That looks like an integral because of the 1 over n. Come on. Ah, there it is. Oh, I guess I'm being wimpy here. The Dirichlet kernel, I guess I should have kept my e to the I n x's. My Dirichlet kernel, back on page 45, is the sum as n goes from minus n to capital N of e to the I n x. And so we realize these are antiderivatives of that. Right, so if I take the derivative of the SNX, I get this. So the aha is, I don't think you have to show this. He gives you this. If I take d by dx of my SN of x, then I get the Dirichlet kernel. There's an n equal 1 term in this, the n equals 0, the n case. So I don't have that term in there. I've got to subtract it here. Okay. And that allows me to say, and this is what he says, he gives you this formula. So Sn of x would be equal to an antiderivative. Where'd that half come from? Oh, okay. I see there's a 1 over 2i in there, isn't there? Oh, yeah, because when I integrate, an I comes out. Sorry. So, yeah, there's a 1. If you think about the 1 over 2i business, which you get 1 half the integral from 0 to x of the Dirichlet kernel minus 1. I'll make this be a dt because I'm anti-differentiating. This is the fundamental theorem of calculus. Okay, and that's what this business about the Dirichlet kernel and the Gibbs phenomenon is all about, this formula. So that's where that comes from. And what you're going to find annoying about this problem is that you've got the Dirichlet kernel in this spot, but he obviously is pushing you to replace the Dirichlet kernel by something easier. So the big trick for this problem, it's going to make it doable, was the hint for problem 12 that you did last week before break. And the big hint was, if I take 1 over t over 2 minus 1 over sine t over 2. That's the denominator in the Dirichlet kernel. Let's call that h of t. And in the solutions to the homework that I wrote out for this problem, you cross multiply and you do L'Hopital's rule twice and you find out that this thing has a limit as t goes to 0. So L'Hopital's rule twice. In fact, that limit shows that h of t goes to 0 as t goes to 0. And what that means is that the Dirichlet kernel is very well approximated by something easier. So let's see if I multiply by sine n plus a half over... Yeah, I'm going to multiply this. Change it back to a t. When I multiply this by sine n plus a half over 2, that is the Dirichlet kernel. And a wiggling sine function is just bounded by 1. So the deal is, you know, these kernels get gigantic. They both do. But even though they're both getting gigantic, their difference is a nice bounded function. And so that allows you, when you want to figure out, you know, what the integral of this thing is doing, you can use this instead. And this is a much easier thing to deal with. And we know the limit of this integral from 0 to infinity is pi over 2. Stuff like that.
So this is the key to this problem. And the deal that makes it work is that this is nice and bounded. Nothing bad happens at 0, for example. Okay, so in problem 20, or 19 rather, you're supposed to show that the sum of that series is bounded. And that's going to fall right out from this, and the fact that you know that integral of this one stays nice and bounded. So I think that'll get you going on that problem. Has anybody sat down and started thinking about number 20? Because this is the Gibbs phenomenon problem. So let's see. Our sawtooth function Sn of x minus pi, it's going to overshoot pi over 2. And remember, that's equal to 1 half the integral from 0 to x of this Dirichlet kernel. And the Dirichlet kernel, remember, looked like this. It gets real big. And then it wiggles. Like that. And it gets up to this gigantic n plus a half spot. Right here, it's n plus a half. And so look at the derivative of this thing is the Dirichlet kernel. So it's going to get bigger and bigger when this is positive. Let's see, there'd be a spot here where it's 1. So if I subtract, this is the Dirichlet kernel minus 1. So let's see, because that derivative is the Dirichlet kernel, when it's positive here, it's going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And how big it gets is going to be the area under this. This is where it turns and goes negative. So the maximum is going to happen right here. the Dirichlet kernel minus 1 is going to go negative here. And so this, the max on that interval happens exactly right here. And the max is the area under this piece. So if I can show that this overshoots by 9%, then that's what Gibbs phenomenon is all about. And the trick is, instead of using the Dirichlet kernel, I'm going to use that nicer, easier kernel. So let's let So it's hard to calculate that area using the Dirichlet kernel, but it turns out to be a snap. So here's what I would suggest you do. Let sigma n of x be the integral from 0 to x of sine n plus a half t over t. Normally you'd have a t over 2 here, but that's where that 1 half comes out. It cancels the 1 half in front of the integral. So that's why I don't have a t over 2 here. It's going to cancel that half. I claimed that the max of this function is going to be really close to the max of our other function, because they're going to differ by something really small. So think about this function. Let's see, its derivative is the sine function, and that has the same limit. It goes up to n plus 2. This derivative is strictly positive. So what we're going to think about in this problem is the max on that first hump. So we want to think about the max of Sn of x, and we're going to take the max on the first hump there. Annoying thing is, this isn't exactly the first hump. But remember, I told you it's increasing. I told you where the max is going to occur. The real thing happens right there. The derivative is positive until I get to that spot, and then whammo, it's negative. So the max has to occur right there. The max on this one's easier. This is the one I want. So I claim the max of this thing and the max of the thing it's easier for me to deal with, namely the sigma n, I guess I'll say it in mathematical language. This max minus that max goes to zero as n goes to infinity, because these two functions differ by something really small.
And it's especially small near zero. It's a nice continuous function that's especially small near zero. And you just have to write out the facts that we've been talking about to see that. Okay. And this function, is you can figure out this max, because this derivative would be strictly positive. Let's see, where is it strictly positive? I claim it peaks in this interval. It's got one peak. It doesn't happen at the end point. Where does it happen? It happens at n plus a half pi. Pi over n plus a half. So the actual peak is going to happen not at the end point, but at the right before the end point. So if you think about where that derivative changes sign, am I giving away too much here? Okay, so here's what you should show. Show Sn of x minus sigma n of x is a function that tends to zero as x goes to zero. So I'd call it h of x, where
h is a continuous function. And h of x goes to 0 as x goes to 0.
That was all set up for you, so that's not going to be hard. And so those maxes, that's what's going to allow you to mess around with this max instead of this max. This one you can calculate, this one you can't. And that's the one that
that's going to give you the magic number that Stein tells you to find. But you know what? Stein made a mistake here. He wrote equal. Did that bother anybody? That's not an equal there. So Stein wanted you to show that max on 0 to pi over n of the sawtooth approximation by Fourier series minus pi over 2, it's not equal to this, but it tends to this. You'll have to make a change of variables in the integral to see that this is what you actually get, minus pi over 2. And so the thing that Stein had, he has an equal here, but this actually tends to it as n goes to infinity.
Which means the Gibbs phenomenon this is the 9% business. This integral can be calculated numerically. You can't find an explicit antiderivative for this thing, but you can calculate it numerically, and this gives you the 9% overshoot business. And no matter how you shrink that down, it's still going to be 9%. In fact, it gets closer and closer to exactly 9%, or exactly this number, as n gets big. That's Gibbs phenomenon.
Any questions about that or homework? So yeah, it's probably important to sit down and start writing it out carefully before Sunday night. And I think with all these hints, it's not going to be too difficult to do for you, I hope.
The point Stein said equal, but that's not true. At least I sure couldn't show that it was true.
Professor?
Yeah.
Why do they give you that they want the max over the integral 0 to pi over n? Why don't they just say max?
Well, let's see, it's because the Fourier series is wiggling. And in fact, it's wiggling, the derivative is wiggling like the derivative of the Dirichlet kernel. So when the Dirichlet kernel is this gigantic positive thing, it's growing like crazy. So then it's definitely increasing. And then when the derivative would be 0 here, that would be the top of a peak, and then it would go, that's the top of the first hump. So we're going from, we only want to go on the first hump. But if you go back to the picture in the very beginning of the sawtooth thing, where's my sawtooth?
See, it's 0 at 0, and then it goes shooting up, growing really fast, because that's when the Dirichlet kernel is gigantic. So it has a gigantic derivative here. And the top of that first peak is where the Dirichlet kernel comes down into 0, basically. Close. There's this minus 1 ping in the neck. And so the top of that first hump, we can figure out where it is pretty good.
But wouldn't that automatically be inside pi over n? Or 0?
It's a little bit in.
Right. So
right.
Couldn't they just, like, how do they know beforehand they want to look at the interval 0 to pi over n?
Because that's where the first, the first 0 of the Dirichlet kernel would be pi over n plus a half n. And that's, so if you go to n pi over n, you go a little bit past that spot where you're past the hump. And that's okay. That's why they take that interval. I guess he just didn't want to say pi over n plus a half. But those are incredibly close together. And when you're dealing with the other thing, sine, yeah, it just makes it easier, I think. So you have the top of that hump, it happens in pi, 0 to pi over n. Mm-hmm. And then it goes down a little bit after that, because from pi over n to pi over n plus a half is a little tiny bit. Anyway, once you understand this, you'll have a deep understanding of Gibbs phenomena and see that it has to be that way. And you remember when we were doing, if you understand this jump, you can understand any jump. Because if a function has a jump, you would subtract, I would shift this and then subtract exactly the right thing to cancel the jump out. And then I would know that Fourier series converges nicely, and I would be able to pull it apart and see that the Fourier series to the original jump thing has the same behavior as the Gibbs phenomena. So knowing it for one sawtooth function like this means you know it for any jump, because you can always subtract the right thing like this to get rid of the jump. And I guess I didn't talk about it. If the jump was at the origin, you could subtract the right thing and get rid of the jump. But you can. There's rules about taking translations of Fourier series. And the translation of a Fourier series is just basically the translation of each term. And so you'd understand this kind of a jump at other places besides zero without doing any more work. So knowing it at zero and knowing it at this function is all you need to know. And this function is kind of beautiful because it's so simple to write down and clean to play around with.
I guess that's what Gibbs. His breakthrough was. Okay, well so the homework is due on Monday. And hopefully with these hints, it will be doable now.
Are people liking Stein's homework? It's pretty demanding, but I find it pretty satisfying if you can figure them out. But somehow he gives you just the right number of hints to make them doable, because if he didn't, they would be pretty horrific problems.
Okay, that's enough for today. So on Friday, I'll start talking about the Fourier integral and the Fourier transform.